You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Sebastian.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I am great. It's a beautiful day in the English countryside where I've holed up for August. I mean, why did I say Europe? For August. Too many transatlantic flights have been scrambling.
I know how that can get you to conflate months and continents. It happens to me all the time. Actually, it doesn't, because I don't take many transatlantic flights. I don't get those kinds of invitations. But let me introduce us. And that'll explain why you do and I don't. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're Sebastian Mallaby, well-known journalist, columnist in the past at places like Financial Times, Washington Post, author of a number of noted books. Most recently, the one we're going to talk about, The Infinity Machine, Demis Hassabis, Deep Mind, and the Quest for Superintelligence. Very well-timed book. Sheds a lot of light on the current technological moment, which is to say the AI moment, which I think is going to last for more than a moment. And I really, really enjoyed it. I listen to books more than read them when I'm going to do a whole book. And this had a low rewind rate, which is a compliment to the book. It means that it held my attention enough that I didn't keep saying, wait a second, what? Let me back up a minute. And one reason is you've chosen such a good vehicle for telling the story of AI. So Demis Hassabis, if there are people who don't know, he was the founder of DeepMind and the leader of DeepMind, which became, through acquisition and integration, the heart of Google's AI operation. And over the last few years, I would say there have been three companies that are most often mentioned as being in the horse race to get to this thing called artificial general intelligence. If you believe that that's a term that makes sense, in any event, they're in some kind of race. And those companies are Google, Anthropic, and OpenAI. And, you know, I was thinking about, like, if you could have chosen the leader of any of those three, you know, Demis or Sam Altman or Dario Amodei, who would you have chosen? And I kind of think you chose well. I'm sure you probably agree, but I'd like to, I really do think, if you want to tell the recent story, the kind of deep learning revolution and the quest for the holy grail of AGI, he's probably the best one. So I just wanted to start by asking you what appeals to you about him as a subject, and what appealed to you, because I guess it was right when the large language model revolution started that you decided to approach him about doing a book. Is that right?
That's right. So what happened was that, you know, around about early 2022, I finished and published my previous book about Silicon Valley through the eyes of venture capital. And I was looking for the next topic, and you know, I flirted with crypto, which was a hot thing at the time, and decided there wasn't quite enough there. I thought about various other things. But then, you know, it seemed to me that there had been these two big events in artificial intelligence. One was the AlphaGo system, the defeat of the human champion at the game of Go, way more complicated than chess, with this enormous combinatorial space. You know, the first move, there's 361 choices, second move, 360. You start multiplying that out, 361, 360, 359, you get to this almost infinitely big number. And so finding patterns in that near infinity of possibilities and permutations, you kind of had invented an infinity machine. So that was pretty remarkable in 2016. And then 2020, you get this even bigger breakthrough, AlphaFold, the unraveling of all the shapes of proteins in nature, or at least most of them. And that was an even bigger search space, even closer to infinity, if that is a concept I'm permitted to float as a layman. And so kind of infinity machine followed by another infinity machine, and it felt like this was a repeatable exercise and AI was going to break out at some point. Okay. And so that was why I chose the subject of AI. And then, as you say, the next question is, who is the human character at the center of the story? And the nice thing about Demis Hassabis is that his lab, DeepMind, had produced both of these breakthroughs that caught my eye, Alpha Fold and Alpha Go before that. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, you know, two other things. Demis himself is a fascinating character. We can get into that. But also his kind of focus on AI started very early, like almost crazy early, right? You know, mm-hmm. way back when he was in his teens, it was the mid-1990s, artificial intelligence systems couldn't even recognize the photograph of a cat. Mm-hmm. And he's already obsessed with the idea of building AI. So his intellectual journey maps onto the creation of modern AI perfectly. You can tell the story through him of the time when you had these incredibly primitive systems that could barely do anything, through the origins of the revolution around 2012 to the absolute, you know, crescendo of competitive craziness that we've got now. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've done that before. So when I wrote about central banking and finance and wanted to understand why the 2008 financial crisis had happened, you know, Alan Greenspan was the character through whom you could tell the making of modern finance. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the same thing with the making of modern AI.
Okay. Yeah. And he, I mean, he has so much to recommend him. For starters, he was among the very first to be talking about artificial general intelligence, in part because the co-founder of DeepMind, Shane Legg, coined the term. So he was really thinking about that early. I mean, you know, with Sam Altman, who knows, you know, what exactly he's had in mind during his relentless climb. He's not at all a tech guy in the sense that Demis Hassabis is, or even that Dario Amodei is. But Demis Hassabis, from the beginning, had a very clear-cut conception, it seems, of why he's interested in AI. And I think that may account for both some of his successes and some of his failures, both of which you talk about in the book. There are times when he bets on the right horse in terms of approach, methodology, and times when he doesn't. And I think, in a way, you know, by his own admission, he does not focus on large language models as early and as intensively as was warranted. And I think, in a way, it all derives kind of from the purity of his vision. Does that make sense to you? I mean, why was he interested in AI in your telling?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, he comes to the subject because, first of all, he's fascinated by all things science. He's fascinated by theoretical physics, by neuroscience. He wants to understand, you know, how biology works at a deep level. And he reckons that, I mean, he puts this as an incredibly presumptuous language, which is only excusable because Demis has achieved so much that he's allowed to be presumptuous. But anyway, right. He says, you know, well, Newton and, you know, Feynman and these other physicists that I revere, you know, basically they failed, right? They didn't fully understand or explain the nature of reality at a deep level. There are things we don't understand. What is time? You know, what is gravity? All these things, we don't fully understand it. And so ultimately they failed. And I mm-hmm. want to do better than that. I want to do better than those people. Mm-hmm. And how do I do better? Well, I have to have a better tool. It's mm-hmm. not that I will be individually smarter. Is that I will invent the tool that will make me smarter, and that tool will be artificial right. intelligence. So this was sort of the early motivating driver. And then in addition, there was the kind of, and this is very interesting, the kind of much more prosaic, almost sort of trivial reason to do it, which is that he was working for this video game design company, and they wanted to build more compelling games. And mm-hmm. to do that, it would be cool if you had a character in the game who developed and, you know, it kind of evinced personality mm-hmm. according to what prompts came from the player, and you could make it more addictive if you did that. And so it went from the kind of super grand to the almost trivial and banal. But anyway, from both angles, he was determined to build AI, and that, you know, that was a particular reason. And I think also, you know, you say, well, you know, in some ways it set him up for some success, but also some failure, and that's true. And I think there the point is that, you know, when Demis was getting to this subject, you know, literally, as I said, AI couldn't recognize the photo of a cat. So mm-hmm. you had this aspiration to build machine intelligence. You had pretty much no idea how you would do it. Mm-hmm. And so what he did was to study not only computer science as a subject for an undergraduate degree, but then later neuroscience as a PhD, so that he could understand human intelligence, which would give him a model of how machine intelligence might turn out to work. And so, and he assembled a team at the beginning of DeepMind in 2010, which consisted of people from lots of different disciplines, some neuroscientists, some mathematicians, some physicists, some computer scientists. And because the field of AI didn't really exist in a mature way, he was inventing it by bringing this eclectic group of thinkers together. And that eclecticism led him to a view that always kind of favored the idea that there wasn't one straight path to strong intelligence. It was going to be a series of out-of-the-box inspirations that blended all these different scientific backgrounds. And whereas Daryamade, in particular, the Anthropic leader, is famous for having very early on spotted the scaling laws, the notion that you could take the existing AI architecture, just make it bigger and bigger and bigger with more compute, more data, and then it would lead to better results. That was kind of a very linear approach to how to make it stronger. And Demis, in a way, embodied the opposite view, which was a nonlinear kind of lots of parallel breakthroughs in different fields. And it was sort of inspired at first as a way to get things going, and mistaken later on when, in fact, Daryamade turned out to have picked the right linear approach.
Yeah. The so as you say, I mean, there's a kind of humility in the grandness of his ambition, in the sense that he's saying, I'm not saying I'm smarter than Richard Feynman. I'm saying any human needs tools to actually bring. I mean, there is this quote near the end of the book that's just striking in its audacity, taken out of context, at least, where he says something like, yeah, I want to solve like physics and the nature of reality, which is still my goal, or it's something like that, you know. And I guess we should keep in mind that he's talking about building the tool that helps him. But I do think this aspiration really does distinguish him from the other two, Altman and
well, particularly from Altman, right? Because I mean, right. Altman dropped out of Stanford, didn't even complete his first degree, let alone get a PhD. Whereas Daryamade, to be fair, you know, was a serious PhD scientist who stayed in academia after his PhD for a bit and did both physics and then biophysics. And, you know, he's much closer to Demis in his scientific formation.
That's true. And I have to admit, he's more of a black box to me. I know less about him than I think I know about Altman and now about Hassabis. But I do think he's more focused than Hassabis on, I think his ambition is a little more concrete and conventional, you might say. I think he's focused very much on how AI will affect the world. And, you know, like he's got a whole grand strategy about China, and Demis Hassabis's only strategy seems to be the laudable one of trying to keep this stuff safe. Like from, as far as I can tell, right, he's not beyond that a particularly, well, there's senses which you must be a political animal to succeed the way he succeeded, but you kind of know what I mean. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think one reason for that comes down to the fact that, again, Demis started so early. So just to reiterate, he set up DeepMind in 2010.
Yeah.
OpenAI was not created till 2015. And then for Anthropic, you know, it's kind of 5 or 6 years after that. So there's a big gap. And one consequence of that gap is that during the 2010s, you know, Demis was kind of, you know, collecting the scars of a AI lab leader, including moments when he did try to engage more explicitly in policy and take a view on how you would really deliver safety. He had all these ideas about special independent governance mechanisms that would oversee the rollout of the AI and have a veto over certain kinds of rollout. And he tried to bring AI to the National Health Service in Britain to improve healthcare outcomes, which was a way of sort of showing that it would be good for the world to have AI. And these experiments mostly failed in a painful, drawn out, expensive way to him. And so I think by the time you get to the kind of the part of the story that everybody knows best, which is the ChatGPT comes out in 2022, and then there's this race to build large language models. By this point, Demis has sort of had the experience of being a policy person, and it didn't really work out. And so he's kind of withdrawn, at least until just recently. We can talk about that. He's withdrawn into, okay, I'm just going to build this stuff because it's above my pay grade to try and ensure its safety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we should spend just a moment on the recent development. I want to talk about it more later in the conversation, but there's was not long ago at all a kind of reshuffling at Google. So he is now chairman of DeepMind, but no longer CEO of DeepMind. I've heard competing theories about what actually that signifies and how happy he is or is not about it, but I haven't really looked into it that deeply. What is your sense of things?
Sure. I mean, I'll give you the kind of negative interpretation, and then I'll say why I think the positive one is more likely to be true. Mm-hmm. The negative view is, look, you know, 1 year ago, roughly, or 9 months ago, Gemini, the Google DeepMind AI model, was judged to be the best of all of them on independent third-party evaluations. Today, it's barely in the top 10. So it's really slipped down the league table of, you know, how good the actual model is.
Uh-huh.
And some people say, well, okay, you know, Demis has not delivered. He's fallen behind. And by the way, various prominent famous AI researchers have quit and either done startups mm-hmm. or they have gone to join the rivals.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, you know, Google needed a switch in leadership. And so they kicked him upstairs to be chairman and they gave the CEO position to somebody else, right? So that's the negative view. The view that I actually believe is that from the start in 2010, you know, Demis had two goals. One was to build artificial general intelligence, kind of, mm-hmm. you know, intelligence that could do anything that humans can do, on a screen at least. And secondly, to make it beneficial for the world and safe for people. And he feels, and this was extremely tangible to me as I spoke to him for hours and hours and hours in 24 and then 2025, and particularly towards the end of our conversations in 2025, he was racked with anxiety about the fact that he succeeded brilliantly in delivering the technology, which is going to be pretty much AGI on the timeline he predicted, kind of around 2030. But he'd failed abjectly in making it safe and beneficial for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Really failed in a way that deeply concerned him. And that he thinks now, because he, as you know, his quote is, we're in the foothills of the singularity, mm-hmm. i.e. it's just around the corner mm-hmm. that we're going to have this scarily powerful artificial general intelligence, and goodness knows what it's going to do to us. So he thinks there's no more time to lose and to delay about trying to make it safe. And so he's going for this sort of different role where he's not managing the day-to-day of the scientific research, because he thinks that, you know, it's almost a fait accompli at this point that you're going to succeed in building the powerful AI. What isn't a fait accompli is getting, you know, the government to take seriously the need to regulate it and to
right.
be safe about it. And so
yeah.
that's why he pivoted.
That's interesting. I mean, you said he felt he had failed, but I think, you know, as your book conveys, it's in a certain sense not something he could have succeeded. In other words, it's the racing dynamic that leads to recklessness. And he did not have the power to stop the race. It's like if, you know, there were too many players, there was too much intense rivalry already. And this is the way, it's the way capitalism works. It's the way geopolitics works. I'm not saying we can't bring it under control. I'm in favor of everyone deepening their awareness of what a profound moment we're in and what conceivably radical reorientation of policy may be in order. But I don't see what he could have done in his position, right?
I agree with that. But the only thing is, he thought he would be able to do something
right
when it came to the moment, because he believed in this almost fantastical idea that there would be one lab rolling
right.
this technology out on
right.
behalf of all humanity. Therefore, there wouldn't be a race dynamic. Therefore, he could take his time and make it safe and so forth. Turns out, you know, it wasn't going to be that way, because humans are disputatious and tribal and jealous, and they all compete. And so there were bound to be multiple labs in multiple countries. And his original sort of self, you know, like his rationale for why this was a safe thing to do turned out to be a fiction. And but he sees that and he's deeply pained by it. And so I think he's almost wanting to do, you know, to make up for it, do his, or at least have his best shot at trying to make up for it.
Well, it's a pretty pervasive fiction. I think Dario Amodei still thinks, I can be the guy. Like, if I get to super intelligence first, I'll help set down the rules. Elon Musk was certainly talking about that in the beginning. Larry Page can't be the guy because we're the good guys. So we have to be the guys. And Sam Altman was savvy enough to say, yeah, I'm like you. I'm a good guy. Can I have some money? And so I've never understood why people, you know, it's so funny the sense in which the people who are driving this revolution are really smart, in the sense in which I sometimes think, I'm not sure how much familiarity you have with the real world. Like, I never understood the idea that you'd have, like, one person would have a monopoly. I guess if you buy the super intelligent scenario where there's going to be this rapid acceleration, so suddenly, like, you've got like a 2-month lead, and suddenly that might as well be an infinite lead because your machine is so much more powerful. And I think that drives Dario's vision of like using it to bring China to its knees or something, I guess. So I can kind of see it. It just seems like if you have much familiarity with the messiness of the world, you should be skeptical of a model like that. I don't know.
Yeah. I think you're right that in the case of Anthropic and Dario Amodei, the attraction of the singleton story is very much connected to the singularity. Like this, you know, your lead may be small now, but if you get to that recursive self-improvement moment,
right,
when you have an AI model that builds the next AI model for you, and then the new one immediately builds the one after that, and so you have this complete kind of vertical acceleration of the power of the technology. So whoever has the lead at that moment goes vertical first, they've kind of won. But then there's a different, I think, sort of set of explanations for this idea that, you know, you could ever have one powerful AI lab kind of dominating the whole field. And I think it's kind of crazy, but it comes back to science fiction. And, you know, people have suggested this to me since I published the book, and I've chatted to people, and they, you know, they point out that, you know, the tone of science fiction, there's also often this one hero who saves the world against invading space aliens. And that was the story in this book, Ender's Game, which Demis pointed out to me as something I had to read in order to understand him. And it's about this boy who shoots all the space aliens down before they can invade the Earth.
And he read it. He read it as a boy or as a, when did he read it?
No, that was a surprising thing. He read it as a PhD student when he was kind of 30 years old. And it had this enormous impact on him. And he got his wife to read it so she could understand him better. There was a point, I didn't put this in the book, but there was a point early in DeepMind's history when the movie of Ender's Game came out, and it was in an IMAX theater. And Demis kind of booked tickets for the entire company. Mm. And it was, you know, a small company, but it was a startup back then. But they all trooped off from the office to go watch this IMAX, you know, movie about this kid and, you know, shooting down the space invaders.
You know,
it meant a lot to him. And it meant a lot to him. And I think that self-image and Oppenheimer and the Manhattan Project and the whole sort of mythology of scientists secluded in the desert creating something which changes the outcome of the Second World War.
Yeah.
These kinds of images matter a lot to scientists.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised, not that there was something like that in his formative background, but that he took such pains to direct you to it, because of course one could look at that and say, wait, you've got a messiah complex, you're crazy. And one could of course look at things that Dario Amodei says and say the same thing. In fact, the most astute thing that I think Pete Hegseth has ever said was to that effect. And you could make that case with Allman. So it's not like it's uncommon in this business to be able to point to somebody and say you have a pretty grand self-conception. But did it surprise you that he wanted to be that open about the magnitude of his self-conception, kind of?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I was surprised when I read the book. What happened was we were having our first dinner, and it was sort of in the courtship phase where he hadn't quite committed yet to give me the access I would need to write the book.
So this is what year?
This is like fall of 2022, maybe just a couple of weeks before ChatGPT comes out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've pitched him on the idea of the book. I've said, look, you know, you keep on saying in all your academic lectures that AI will be the most important invention in the history of humanity. And if that's the case and you're leading this race, then you're going to be one of the most important people in this same history. And so, you know, there are going to be books about you, and don't pretend you can hide. So you might as well talk to me. That was my pitch. And he was thinking about it. And part of the vetting was that I had to go to have dinner with him. And he said, before you come, you're going to read two books. And one of them is Ender's Game. So I read this book, the science fiction story, and I was surprised that he'd kind of given it to me, because is he really telling me he's like this messianic figure who saves all of humanity? And then I show up and I say, and he says to me immediately, well, I hope you read Ender's Game, because it really is crucial to understanding me. And I identify with Ender, and that's, you know, and I was surprised. But at the same time, as I thought about it, you know, most people, this would be absurd. But with Demis, I mean, he did actually have the vision of building AI, you know, 15 or 20 years before it was possible to do anything with it. He did then shepherd it through. And, you know, because of him, it started to work. Bits of it started to work directly because of him. And then he pursues this vision and other people start to copy him. But basically, he is the, you know, you could say he's at least one of a very short list of people responsible for ushering this technology into the world. And so, you know, I know, I mean, maybe I'm just, you know, temperamentally disposed to feel that there's enough negativity in the world, people taking shots at each other. And if somebody is trying to explain themselves and is open enough to say, this is how I feel about myself, I'm more inclined to say, well, that's an interesting self-explanation than to say you're nuts. I'm more interested in explaining people than in condemning them.
I wouldn't have recommended your nuts as the deal closer when you were trying to talk him into cooperating. No. You presented as you should, and you let people form their own judgments, and it's not that exceptional. And look, people who know me will be like, who are you to complain about people trying to save the world? But and I'm not. I mean, I finished the book with a whole lot of admiration for him. And in a way, to get back to the distinction with Dario Amodei, one way to think of it is, you know, Demis Hassabis wanted to understand the universe. I really believe that. There's a moment fairly early on when he says, I just look around at reality and I'm like, why is it like this? Like, why is it intelligible? Why is there this structure? And of course, that may be a deeper question than even AI could wind up illuminating. Who knows? But in any event, I'm sold. I think all of his behavior kind of makes sense, including his failures, in light of the purity of the aspiration. And one way I'd contrast it, you know, Dario Amodei, very smart, very interested in science. He pursued some of the same. I think he, like Demis, is interested in neurology and physics. But whereas Demis is talking about like science, Dario's phrase is, a data center, a country of geniuses and data center. Right. It's like he's immediately thinking geopolitics. It's like we could have a country with people smarter than all the Nobel laureates, and then you'd have this super powerful country. And like, I don't now. Maybe I'm extrapolating too much from what he actually says, but I do think that's a very different direction to take the sheerly intellectual power of AI and the scientific power than the one that Demis takes it in. I guess that's the way I'd put it.
I think the country thing is sort of a metaphor. I wouldn't read too much into that.
It is. You know, and look, he's trying, of course, he wants to sell it. He wants to keep the nation behind it because he needs national policy to be consistent with his aspirations and so on. It makes sense. And he's a little bit of a black box to me. It's interesting to look at, as we said, Demis doesn't bet on large language models as early as he kind of maybe wishes he had. But there are a lot of important things about the deep learning revolution that are themes in what he does do. So the whole business of creating this great Go player by just having it play games against itself and learning things, you know, as you say, that's like, I mean, you say in the book, if you haven't said it yet, That's like inductive learning. And that's just central to the whole deep learning revolution. It's not always clear that it's induction because we can't always see the actual crystallization of principles and generalizations, but they must be kind of happening in some sense based on a lot of input of data. And that is something that AlphaGo has in common with large language models, with image recognition systems. It's the inductive thing is maybe, would you say is, if there's one single theme to characterize the deep learning revolution, is that what you'd pick?
Yeah, 100%. And that goes back to this idea of an infinity machine, which I took for the title of my book, precisely because induction is absolutely central to what this whole AI revolution is about. Because prior to deep learning and, you know, let's say, you know, we'll go back to 1995. Demis Hassabis is an undergraduate at Cambridge doing computer science, and the training in computer science is based on sort of deductive syllogisms, formal logic, you know, if A, then B, and so forth. And the goal is to kind of reduce one's understanding of reality into a series of deductive logical statements. And he revolted against that. He rebelled mm-hmm. against it mm-hmm. together with his best friend, David Silver, who then later became his partner in doing science, both at a startup and then at DeepMind. And, you know, David Silver was the lead scientist on AlphaGo. So very central person in my book. And the two of them together, David Silver and Demis Hassabis, are there as undergraduates and saying, wait, you know, deduction isn't enough to explain how we think as humans. And we're constantly using induction. We're taking in lots of examples and we're generalizing from them. Mm-hmm. We're not deducing logically. Now, the nature of induction, and Bob, this is very much your sweet spot, so tell me if I get this a bit wrong, but the nature of induction is you need a lot of examples in order to induce anything. And anything you induce, any generalization you extract from all the examples you've been shown, is subject to revision if you get more examples that show mm-hmm. your original hypothesis wrong. You know, mm-hmm. Induction is always sort of provisional. And therefore, in order to have a strong inductive AI, it needs to consider almost an infinity of examples to make sure that the inductive conclusions are as strong as possible. Mm-hmm. And so the whole goal of AI is essentially to break free from that 1995 Cambridge University computer science approach of deductive logic and build a new kind of AI that thinks inductively and therefore that must handle almost infinite quantities of data to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And that is the whole essence of the challenge, to build an infinity machine, which means an induction machine.
Right. And that's, you know, one reason I think you alluded to, I think it's 2012 when the image recognition paper by Sutskever and Hinton and AlexNet, I guess it is. The prerequisite for that was this researcher, Fei-Fei Li, who was at Princeton, assembling this huge database of labeled images, which took a lot of work. Right. He had to have humans look at everyone and go, that's a dog, and write it underneath. And then it was because of that huge assemblage of training data that the image recognition systems could make such a leap in success. So exactly as you say, it's just more examples and a greater diversity of examples that lead the way. And that helps account for the data part of the scaling laws, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so that was true for deep learning, kind of, which is sort of a, you know, you feed lots of data into an AI and it looks at the examples and extracts patterns. It's also true, though, for the parallel sort of strand of AI, reinforcement learning, where, you know, the AI acts in its environment and gets a feedback signal and learns from the signal whether the action was constructive or not constructive. Mm-hmm. And so this is not learning from data. This is learning from experience. You could sort of say that the experience of taking an action in an environment, getting a feedback signal, that experience becomes data. Once you've collected mm-hmm. lots of experience, you have a lot of data. So reinforcement learning is in a way of getting, you know, other data that doesn't exist already. And so either way, you're making sense of the patterns in lots of data. But reinforcement learning, you know, was Demis Hassabis's breakthrough in 2012, parallel to that AlexNet breakthrough you just described. AlexNet was about feeding these labeled images of cats and so forth and getting the system to recognize a cat. The parallel DeepMind Demis Hassabis story was training an AI to play primitive video games like Pong, Breakout, you know, these Atari games from the 70s and 80s. And the system would basically start playing a game like Pong, moving the paddle up and down the screen randomly. And then randomly would either, you know, intercept the ping pong ball and knock it back and get a point, or miss it and not get a point. And it would just figure out, based on that feedback signal, point or not point, which are the right moves to make with the ping pong racket. And at the end of 2012, almost simultaneously with the famous AlexNet image recognition breakthrough, DeepMind produces this system it calls DQN, which is the first, you know, successful agent that, based on reinforcement learning, can teach itself to play a game like Pong.
Yeah. So again, the themes, more than you might guess, to look at his successes, his main successes, you know, you immediately think of AlphaGo, of course, AlphaFold, the protein folding thing. To look at those and large language models, you know, you might underestimate the extent to which the critical themes were actually evident in his work. And another example is actually reinforcement learning. I mean, they were kind of there first. That turned out to be a critical supplement to the training of a large language model in a very different way. And they were there, you know, all the elements were kind of floating around, including, by the way, I mean, his very start in video games. You know, you talked about you know, building more complex characters. Well, that's, in a way, you're building autonomy. You're trying to build as much autonomy as you can, which is the holy grail along one dimension. More broadly, I might say that there are still people who say, look, large language models are great, but until you have a true world model, like, you know, something that can go through the world and apprehend, you know, adjust to the physical world and shades of light and everything else the way a person does, and kind of understand intuitively that things that are dropped fall downward and so on, you won't have the whole thing. And video games are kind of an approach to a world model, right? And Google has kind of remained in the, I think there's, you know, in the world model realm. I mean, judging by their video simulation stuff, that's still a real strong suit of theirs. But like, he's big on world models, I guess. I mean, of course, Jan LeCun thinks they're the end all and be all, but I assume Demis Hassabis agrees that they're a critical, there's a big step beyond LLMs in that sense.
Sure. And this goes to kind of like, in a way, the heart of the reason why DeepMind fell behind OpenAI, because Demis Hassabis was so convinced that world models were important that circa sort of 2018, when OpenAI produced the first GPT model, you know, Demis was more focused on various kinds of world model experiment. They had this ambition when they were building their new headquarters around that time to have an entire wall of the office covered by a massive screen with all these AI characters who would be running around performing tasks in a simulation of the real world. So they would be picking fruit and whatever. And the key to this idea was that, you know, many simulations, many kind of, you know, video games are set in urban environments or very abstract environments where there are right angles, everything is very sort of predictable, standardized shapes and so forth. If you think about, you know, a chair, one designer will design the chair and then the factory will make 5,000 of them. And so it's quite standardized. Mm-hmm. Think about the room you're sitting in, you know, there'll be, you know, vertical walls, hopefully, and horizontal floors and right angles that where they connect. Whereas, you know, the natural world is contoured and irregular, and the range of sizes between a redwood tree and an ant is massive, and it's just much more complicated to navigate because it's so heterogeneous. And so they at DeepMind, Demis had this idea for covering the whole wall with this natural world environment in which agents would be learning to operate in the real world, and basically building a world model precisely as people today argue, oh, that's the next thing we need to do. He was doing it before LLMs in like 2018. And that distracted him from going after language models as early as OpenAI did. And that's why DeepMind fell behind for a while. Now, you know, it's coming back, as you say. So these things, these different approaches to AI go in cycles. And I think you're right that today Google, which has quite a big investment in robotics, you know, maybe ahead of Anthropic or OpenAI on sort of the physics type, the physics approach to artificial intelligence.
Yeah, the your book helped me realize one reason or one way in which I had underestimated his contribution, and it has to do with the now kind of famous misconception that you've already alluded to that surrounds the very birth of artificial intelligence. I mean, if you want to locate that at the Dartmouth conference in the late 1950s, for example, where the dominant approach for some time to come is a kind of like formal logic approach, like as if the human mind is the mind of a mathematician and all of reality can be converted into symbols and you manipulate them in accordance with formal rules and then out comes the answer. And now, kind of famously, the world seems to be in some sense messier than that. And when I first became aware of like AlphaGo, my intuition was to put it in this category of like not messy enough to be useful because it's a game and it has these rules. It's like the real world isn't anything like the game of Go. But then, you know, I now do clearly realize a fundamental thing was it was inductive. And, you know, it was learning on the basis of a lot of stuff. And in fact, you know, inductive in a way that remains somewhat opaque to us. That's the fascinating thing about these machines is that they must be in some sense generalizing and we get better at understanding the senses in which they are. In other words, they must be doing something like inference, but the magic is that you don't really have to follow exactly what they're doing to set them up so that they'll do it. And that's where AlphaGo, that's where he is very, very early in the game at that kind of generic level, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was precise. I mean, I called the chapter about AlphaGo in my book Intuition because that's sort of what it was simulating. And, you know, human, it's important to distinguish here between chess and Go. Chess, you've got an 8x8 board. So there's only 64 squares. As opposed to 361 in a Go board. So that immediately reduces the number of permutations a lot. And then secondly, you know, a lot of the pieces in a chess game are blocked, particularly at the beginning. And so the number of moves you can make is actually quite tractable. And so when IBM defeated Garry Kasparov with its Deep Blue system in 1997, you know, that was a sort of deductive thing where, you know, you crunched through all the possible moves and all the possible counter moves and built this sort of tree search system. And with a few tweaks, you know, brute force was most of what you needed to get there to a system that could beat the human champion. Whereas in Go, forget it. I mean, there's just way too many permutations for it to be tractable by just doing straight tree search. And so what humans do when they look at the Go board is they see the pattern of the pieces and they intuit what the powerful move is next. It is a pattern. You know, you look at a pattern, you recognize a pattern, and you're kind of, based on other patterns you've seen, you're inducing what would be the right move. And you're not doing kind of, if I do this, the he'll do that. If I do this, you know, you can't do that. It's just too many permutations. And it's the same for the computer. That can't do it either. So you are having to kind of build up a computer version of human intuition of just looking at the position and coming up with the move. And that's sort of what they did with Go.
Yeah. So what, What about his leadership qualities? They must be pretty considerable. You know, I mean, as you said, one thing that happened in recent years at Google is that a few, you know, kind of, I mean, very recently, within the last few months, is that some very prized talent left. I can imagine a number of explanations for that. I mean, Google is just a very big company, and there are downsides that come with that. And I'm sure some of those downsides are beyond Demis Hassabis' control and were, in fact, frustrations for him. So I have no idea what the deal was there, but he clearly was, in some senses, a very successful leader. How would you characterize the source of his success, you know, kind of the key ingredients of his appeal as a leader? And for that matter, anything you want to say about weaknesses?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's this early story, which I think kind of sums up his skill as a leader, which is that, you know, he founded, after he left Cambridge, he founded a startup called Elixir to build video games, which was his way of trying to earn some money to then be able to do AI. Mm-hmm. And so he, you know, they built a kind of prototype of a game. David Silver was his key sort of, you know, collaborator on this. And they flew off to a massive, you know, game kind of conference, a kind of, you know, where you pitch your idea and then hopefully some big studio will come and give you some money to carry on developing it. And so this massive, great warehouses in, I think it was outside LA. And there they are, they're going to present this game. And, you know, all the big honchos from the industry come to watch. And Demis is standing up, you know, showing a demo of this game, and it crashes. And it's utterly impossible to revive it. And then he does revive it briefly, but as it's revived down the screen, you know, kind of as the system is booting up, the system outputs the type of computer it's working on as it's kind of blinking and booting itself up again. And that reveals that they've stuffed enormous amounts of extra random access memory into the system to make it even half work. Which you're not meant to do because you're supposed to sell the game to a guy with a normal computer who's going to play the game on his regular computer. And they've just revealed to the studio bosses that there's no way that this game can be played on a normal computer. You need to have like six times the normal amount of RAM. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so it's a complete disaster. And David Silver, who's been responsible for the computing behind the system, is so mortified that he just runs out of the room in horror and like hides for a few hours. And then finally he recovers and goes to find Demis to apologize for having screwed up the demo. And Demis says, what do you mean? No need to apologize. You know, we won the prize for the most promising game out of, you know, sort of 4,000 or something that's been presented. Because even though the system crashed, Demis told such a persuasive story about what the mm-hmm. game would do. Mm-hmm. His vision of it was so compelling that he talked his way out of this disaster. And they called him the Jedi, his co-founders. Because he would look in your eyes and say, you will believe these things. And then people would believe them. He was extremely persuasive and charismatic.
Does he have a little Steve Jobs in him in that way? They used to talk about the reality distortion field that Jobs kind of emanated.
Yeah, yeah, I think, frankly, yes, he does. And I think that's a common trait in lots of successful leaders.
Yeah.
They distort reality, and that inspires people to come and follow them.
Dario Amodei's got something because none of his founders have left. And that puts him in contrast to, I think, all other AI companies, maybe. But anyway, I'm not sure exactly what it is, but he's got something.
I think he's got, yeah, I think his, maybe that's a bit different. Maybe I think he's got sort of incredible conviction and clarity about what he believes. Both how you're going to build it, but also how you're going to make it safe and ethical. And he doesn't mind saying that forcefully. And he'll say it in public and pick a fight with the Trump administration.
Yeah.
And that's a costly thing to do. And he doesn't mind doing it. So I think that is what garners loyalty in his case.
Yeah, I mean, it's costly and not. I mean, he's building up credit within the organization among a certain kind of very talented worker.
Correct.
So, but, and you know, in the past, something I said may have suggested, I believe, that Amadei's not interested in AI safety at all. And Asaba says, it isn't that simple. They have very different approaches. I mean, Amadei is like, if I build the machine in America and we use it to get hegemony, everything will be fine, kind of. And that's a path. At least that's, you can infer that from one body of his writing. He may say other things elsewhere. Whereas Hassabis, though, from the beginning, he thought we should right now, right, try to unify the research project. I mean, I don't know that he spent a lot of time trying, but that wasn't that the vision? Like, it'll be like a global Manhattan project. Like, the world will see that we need to develop this together and control it together.
Yeah, he does have that vision. He did tell Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, to do the international conference at Bletchley in late 2023, mm-hmm. To try to get lots of different AI leaders from all around the world, including the Chinese, in the room. So yes, he is by instinct very much an internationalist. I mean, my sense of Dario Amadei's position is it's less that he's thrilled about American hegemony and more that he's horrified by Chinese hegemony.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a difference.
Yeah. I mean, it's by default, I guess, that he's that he wants to bet on this horse in a way. But yeah, he is very horrified by that. So listen, we've reached the point of the conversation where we go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. You can go to nonzero.org and become one, or click the link in the show notes. At nonzero.org, you'll see the post for this conversation. That's one way to become one. In any event, Sebastian, I want to say again, it's a great book. I wanted to give you a chance to do any kind of summing up before we go into overtime, and any if you think there's a big theme we haven't missed. I mean, again, you know, Asaba is just a great vehicle for telling like this very big and important story. And a very enthralling character in his own right. But what would you, what do you want to say beyond that?
So, yeah, I think the sort of, to sum up, I would say, look, there is this central question about him, which is, you've got somebody who wants to be good. He is a decent person who cares about humanity. I'm certain of that, having spent so much time with him. But the question is, can he be good, right? Can an individual running a scientific lab deliver the beneficial artificial intelligence that he always wanted to deliver? And, or is there some sort of tragedy where he's caught up by his own wishfulness in thinking that there would be a single lab rolling it out on behalf of all humanity? And that was always naive. And it's sort of a tragedy of that assumption. And, you know, this is still playing out, by the way. I mean, Dennis mm-hmm. Asabis, in his new role as chairman, not CEO of DeepMind, is going to spend more time trying to focus on encouraging governments to roll it out safely. But I think, in a way, that is the central animating question. And therefore, is it excusable that a brilliant scientist should carry on building artificial intelligence in the absence of a certainty that it will be safe? And my view is, at the end, you know, that in a way, humanity has always confronted these dilemmas with new technology, that on the one hand, it's exciting, there's lots of potential. On the other hand, it's dangerous and it could be destructive. Mm-hmm. And we always take that trade and go forward with it because, you know, it's not just I think, therefore I am. It's like I invent, therefore I am. Humans are an inventive species.
Yeah.
And so in some sense, the story of Demis Hassabis is sort of an enlarged version of the story of you and me and everybody else.
Yeah, it's a story we've seen before. It's bigger than most of them, I think, in its implications. So I hope people follow us into overtime. And in any event, thanks for listening this far. And here we go.